This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Among the stars presenting statuettes at the Academy Awards last night was Tyler Perry. He was an executive producer of Precious. The film won Oscars for Best Supporting Actress and Adapted Screenplay.
They just said my name at the Oscars. I better enjoy it because it'll probably never happen again.
Tyler Perry is a tall, handsome guy who's written, directed, and starred in half a dozen hit movies, mostly centering on women. But here's where the probably never happen again comes in. Perry became a star playing a foul-mouthed grandma with a gun.
I ain't scared of no popo call, the popo honk call, the popo.
On stage and screen, Madea made Tyler Perry into one of the biggest names in black entertainment. As NPR's Netta Ulaby reports, Perry is spinning his popular success into an opportunity to tell more serious stories.
Tyler Perry, triple threat, makes hit movies, TV shows, and plays about fractious families.
Hell to the no, this is blasphemy. Our daddy was a saint.
Your daddy was a pimp.
About women in romantic distress.
For goodness sake, you see a man touching all over me, and you do nothing about it. You call yourself a husband. You are a punk.
And when he's not producing two successful cable TV shows, Perry is not afraid to put on a dress and stomp around playing Medea, a grandma who literally praises the Lord and passes the ammunition.
You see, when I got saved, thank you. I mean, when I saved the rest of them bullets.
Perry clearly gets an enormous kick out of playing his signature character, a rowdy old hellraiser who thumps kids when they're sassy, when she's not threatening to shank them. Tyler Perry admits his work is not exactly highbrow.
What people forget, because I'm often criticized because the movies are so predictable and so simple, I'm writing for 2-year-olds to 90-year-olds. My fan base is so broad, so I tell a simple story on purpose.
Perry's stories rely on a blend of faith and comedy to appeal to a largely female, largely Christian audience who've transformed this former high school dropout into one of the entertainment world's most formidable new figures. But the criticism he's received has been harsh. Filmmaker Spike Lee used racially loaded words to describe Perry's TV shows, coonery and buffoonery. Melvin Peters is a professor of African American literature, and he says Spike Lee has a point.
When you look at those shows, buffoonery comes into it. Black woman slapping the man upside the head, telling jokes about the crackhead woman character.
Next time you on crack, pick me up one of those $20 Rolexes.
You're on perilous ground when you present these things as humorous, you know? I mean, what crack has done to the African American community, African American women in particular? These are troubling things, you know.
But Perry says he is passionate about telling women's stories. It's always been the basis of his artistic drive, as well as the source of his financial success. Still, Perry's approach to women's stories has recently diversified, dramatically.
My name is Clarice Precious Jones. I want to be on the cover of a magazine.
The movie Precious, based on the novel Push by Sapphire, could not be more different from Tyler Perry's previous projects. Precious grapples with social problems seriously. It's artsy, disturbing, and new for Perry, critically acclaimed. But what attracted Tyler Perry to the film was his identification with the main character, an obese, illiterate teenage girl abused by her mother, played by the actress Monique.
So those things that she told you I did to her, who else was going to love me?
You know, my mother was my protector growing up because I was in a house like the one in Precious, and my father was Monique's character. So she would take me everywhere with her to protect me. So I went to hair salons, and I went to the Lane Bryant, and I would listen to all these women, you know, a little boy listening to all this. I soaked up everything. So a lot of times when I'm writing, I'm thinking about those women and those experiences.
Tyler Perry's used those experiences for his movies, TV shows, and plays throughout his entire career. He says Medea comes from the same place as Precious. She's based on real women, who have also been his intended audience. Now, though, Perry wants his stories about women to have a broader reach.
I've kind of painted myself in a box with the Tyler Perry brand.
While he's not going to abandon Medea, Perry says he'll soon retire her for a while.
It's very risky. It's very risky on so many levels. That's why I started this other company to do these types of films.
Perry has essentially started an art house division called 34th Street Productions. It's named for Miracle on 34th Street because Perry says his life is a miracle. In his 20s, he lived in his car while writing a musical that eventually found a following in the black theater circuit. Now, not two decades later, Perry owns a massive movie studio in Atlanta. There, he's now filming an adaptation of a play that embodies the revolutionary thrill of black feminism and identity politics in the 1970s.
My spirit is too ancient to understand the separation of soul and gender. My love is too delicate to have thrown back in my face.
Written by playwright Entezake Shange, For Colored Girls Who Have Considered Suicide When the Rainbow Is Enough ran on Broadway and was earlier filmed for public television.
My love is too beautiful to have thrown back on my face.
All right, y'all.
My love is too take it to the bridge to have thrown back on my face.
For Colored Girls is a staple of black literature courses, like the ones taught by Professor Melvin Peters.
Entezake Shange is a writer of great intelligence and great stature, and her work is classic.
The play lyrically delves into different aspects of black womanhood through a chorus of seven actresses, colorfully identified as the Lady in Red, the Lady in Yellow, the Lady in Blue.
Orange butterflies and aqua sequins and sconce green slight bosoms. Silk roses darting from behind my ears. The passion flower of Southwest Los Angeles. Meanders down Hoover Street.
You know, the story was so rich, and I didn't know, because it was written, you know, when I was born, and I didn't know how powerful and how amazing it was.
In fact, Tyler Perry did not particularly care about For Colored Girls. It was acquired by a member of his staff, and for a while, he says, it was nothing but a problem.
We were kept giving notes and couldn't get the script right, and we couldn't figure it out. So I finally started paying attention to it, and I was like, wait a minute, whoa, this stuff is great.
The notion of Medea directing For Colored Girls shocked some black intellectuals. Tyler Perry does not blame them.
I'm shocked, too. I think they have every right to be shocked. And I've even seen outrage. How dare you touch this? We don't want this to be this way. But rest assured, there'll be no Medea in the movie. And they can also rest assured that I'm going to stay very true to what Entezake's done.
And maybe Tyler Perry can help guide the play to a new generation of young women, says African-American literature professor Melvin Peters.
As long as he doesn't play one of the roles.
Tyler Perry's For Colored Girls began filming last fall. He's scripting, directing, and producing it. Perry's been cagey about the cast, but it's rumored to include friends like Oprah Winfrey and Jill Scott. The movie is scheduled for release next year. Tyler Perry's latest romantic drama, Why Did I Get Married 2, will be in theaters next month. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Michelle Norris. American Idol is still the most popular TV show in the country, but the show has a problem. Among the singers this season, none has really caught on with fans. The real suspense is at the judges' table. The sharpest and most incisive judge, Simon Cowell, is leaving. And commentator Andrew Wallenstein has an idea for how to replace him.
Cherish every last moment with Simon Cowell.
I agree. I don't want to make this any worse than it already is because, you know, it was a complete and utter mess.
No one crushes the human spirit quite as brilliantly as he does.
There's a certain irony for you singing a song about climbing when you actually fell off.
Cowell is planning on bringing his signature blend of good cheer and loving kindness to a new show, X Factor. That's bad enough for Idol, but what's worse is that's not the only problem the show has at the judges' table. New judge Ellen DeGeneres is, well, I'll put it as delicately as Cowell would. She's horrible.
I still feel like I can't believe you're 17, right?
Now, I have nothing against DeGeneres. She's a terrific talk show host. Her complete lack of musical knowledge, that's not even the problem. DeGeneres seems uncomfortable, stifled, just plain not funny.
But I'm going to be specific. I want it to be like a young, hip song, because you have a great voice, but I just feel like you're still... Not singing something that's right for your age.
If I were an Idol producer, I'd be searching for replacements for both Cowell and DeGeneres. The rumor mill's already spinning on Cowell's successor. Shock jock Howard Stern and music mogul Tommy Mottola have been floated as possibilities. Even Food Network personality Paula Deen, which makes just about no sense.
You know, if we have some picky eaters come in, I can fix them right up with chicken. Kicking chicken.
There must be a better way to cast the right judge. But have no fear. I've come up with a strategy to turn this difficulty into opportunity. What better way for a show dedicated to finding the best undiscovered singer in America than to spin off a new series that searches for the best judge in America?
Only one will win. The ultimate dream job.
Think about it. Food Network and HGTV already have reality shows in which the winning contestants are awarded their own shows.
After every challenge, we will meet here and see if you have what it takes to be HGTV's design star.
So, allow me to propose Judge Idol, or American Judge. The name doesn't matter. We'll round up all the singers we've grown to love on past seasons of Idol, and they'll critique the judge's critique. And trust me, Sanjaya, he's not doing anything else. He'll have time for this. To Idol's producers, I say we're doing this for your own good. If DeGeneres is any indication, you can't pick judges any better than anyone else. So why not let America be the judge of who should be the next judge?
Andrew Wallenstein is an editor for The Hollywood Reporter.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
In his infinite wisdom, David Wallace has authorized us to put on a little presentation about the history of Dunder Mifflin.
Yep. Old comedy team is back together again.
That's right.
Have you heard the news?
X-ray, read all about it. Newspapers for sale.
That's Steve Carell and my guest Amy Ryan in a scene from the NBC series The Office. Ryan played Holly Flax, a human resources officer who may very well be Michael Scott's soulmate, although they're no longer together. You may also know Ryan from another great TV series, HBO's The Wire. She played Port Officer Beattie Russell. Ryan received a Best Supporting Actress Oscar nomination for her role in the 2007 film Gone Baby Gone, and Tony Award nominations for her performances in Uncle Vanya and A Streetcar Named Desire. Ryan co-stars in the new film Green Zone, which opens tomorrow. It's directed by Paul Greengrass, who directed the Bourne movies. Green Zone is a thriller set in Iraq after the invasion. Matt Damon plays an army officer leading a team searching for weapons of mass destruction. Each site he's been told will have WMD has ended up having nothing, so he's growing suspicious of the secret source giving the information. Amy Ryan plays a Wall Street Journal correspondent who reported that there were WMD in Iraq, but she's growing skeptical of her source. In this scene, Damon has just met with a CIA officer who's also skeptical about the WMD claims. They talked poolside in the protected green zone where they were seen by Amy Ryan. She introduces herself to Damon.
You're in the 85th. That's WMD unit, right?
How'd you know that?
It's right there on your rifle. Lori Dane, Wall Street Journal. How's it going?
You know, we haven't found yet. Okay. Hey, Sergeant Perry.
We'll find it. It's frustrating, right?
A little bit.
So what are you and Marty talking about?
Oh, you know, I can't talk to you about that.
Oh, come on. You come in fresh off the field to have a lemonade with Martin Brown? Something's got to be going on.
Well, you could ask him.
I'm asking you. Does it make sense to you that we're still coming up empty?
No. No, it doesn't.
Amy Ryan, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, there's all kinds of, like, technical advisors and stuntmen for the movie Green Zone, and for your part, you didn't need any of that.
I did, actually.
You
need
did?
That. Yeah, and I had the pleasure of speaking with Anne Garrels before I started this film. A friend of mine put me in touch with her, and because, you know, detail is important to me in a film or anything I do, and if anything is going to stick out like a sore thumb, I don't want to be around it. So, I spoke with Anne on the phone one day, and she went through as much as she could in the time she had, her experience, even down to the type of clothes that she would pack and what she would wear and what was in her bag and what her pad looked like and what kind of pen she had. And so, and as well as Rajiv Chandrasekharan, he was on set now and again, and he would help me out as well.
He wrote the book that the movie is very, very loosely adapted from.
Right, Imperial Life in the Emerald City.
So it's interesting that you spoke to Anne Garrels and not Judith Miller, because a lot of people will assume that part of your character is inspired by Judith Miller,
yes,
who was misled by sources about WMD.
Right. I mean, she is probably the most famous. I mean, certainly her articles that were in the New York Times, you know, were a great source. One of the reasons we all said, well, they must be there. We must go to war. So she's the one that came to mind. But Paul Greengrass and I, when we got on set, we thought, well, it's almost too obvious, you know, to, you know, didn't want to suddenly cut my hair short with, you know, dye it dark brown with bangs and try to emulate her physically in any way. Because my character really represents a bunch of journalists who got it wrong in the press. And it could be from, you know, UK paper or American paper. It didn't really matter as much as it mattered that I represent the failures in the press on the whole.
Now, I read part of the movie was reshot.
Yes, we did a bunch of reshoots about, I think it was about 6 or 7 months after we first joined up, because Matt Damon had gone away to do both Invictus and The Informant. And then we joined back up in Morocco right around the election. Actually, I was in Morocco on the election. And thanks to also CGI involved in the film, you would never know. Some of the reshoots were in London and part of the other scene was shot in Morocco, and you'd never know it.
What about continuity? Like, say you gain 2 pounds or you've cut your hair or something's like ever so slightly changed and it has to be consistent with how you looked months earlier.
Matt Damon did put on weight for The Informant. And in between that time, he was frantically working out and trying to get back his military look. I mean, he had quite the transformation in between. I just didn't cut my hair. That was my big job. I waited, you know, we all knew we were coming back for reshoots, so I didn't want to mess with it too much the way I didn't want to get too involved the way he had. But, you know, incredible crew who'd kind of keep all that intact for you. But there was a time, actually, there's a scene I have in the movie with Matt, and it's so subtle. But we did the first part of the scene, we shot Morocco the first time around. And then when the cameras turned around on him, we were in Morocco 7 months later. And then when they turned around on me, I was in London 2 weeks later. And the only difference, I mean, every hair is in place. I had this messy ponytail. Every single strand of hair was in place, except my forehead didn't have a little bit of a dewy sheen because it was colder in London. So I wasn't, you know, as warm as I was in Morocco. But that is the only thing that I could tell, that it wasn't all continuous.
You know, watching the movie, I wanted to learn more about your character, the reporter. And I couldn't help but wonder if maybe there was part of your character's story that was edited out at the end.
Well, we started one of the original scripts. I mean, we tried to show a little bit of the backstory with the character of Poundstone, because how does she have this access, you know, to these senior officials? And, you know, there was a quick scene that just implied that they had had a romantic relationship in the past, so they were very familiar with each other. But
this is the Greg Kinnear character who
yes,
is your
that's right.
misleading source about the WMD.
My misleading source, exactly.
And he works for the Bush administration, and he's one of the key people in the Green Zone overseeing the occupation.
Yes. And, you know, we like to say there's a scene where things got a little quiet in the Green Zone, and Matt Damon and I have a chat about where you come from and what brought you here, soldier, you know, one of those scenes. And it just seemed out of place. And I think also it diminished her a bit in some way, that being the only woman in a movie, therefore there must be sex involved or some kind of romance. And we just thought there wasn't any time for that. And let's just keep the story moving forward, because it is, you know, really the story is just a thriller and a chase movie, and we had to keep that energy going forward.
Now, was it your first thriller chase movie?
Yes, it was, yeah.
What were the ups and downs of doing a thriller chase movie? And I should say you're not in the chases.
Well, the way Paul Greengrass works is sometimes we did film a lot of scenes that he wasn't sure if they would end up in the movie or not. So there would be a day where Greg and I, we were going through, we had a tour of Saddam's torture chambers. And as we're going through there, Paul says, you know, you're going to hear some gunshot and just, you know, just run out and follow it. Just and Amy, just try to get the story and go. You're like, what? And so, you know, there's a huge crew and a bunch of extras and here come the gunshot. And it's part of it. You know, your heart starts pounding. I mean, it sounds like real gunshot and you're running over real rubble. And, you know, there's lots of military pulling up and here comes Matt jumping out of the Humvee. And in some ways you go back to just being a kid, you know. These, you know, the games you make up on the spot with your friends. It was kind of like that, but with a bigger budget. So that part was thrilling. I loved it. I loved it. I didn't know what to expect. And I guess in terms of the downside, and I wouldn't say this is such a negative as much as you just didn't know where. I feel in some ways as an actor, you're more of a pawn across a chessboard. You know, there's a, you know, as opposed to a real deep character study. You know, these characters are really just there to move the story along.
My guest is Amy Ryan, and she co-stars in the new movie Green Zone. Let's do a little retrospective of some of your work, starting with The Wire, which is where I think many people first discovered you. This is the HBO series The Wire, and you started in it in, what, 2003?
That's right, yes. I joined the second season of the show when the story went to the port. Mm-hmm. I played Port Police Officer Beattie Russell.
Yeah, and who's also a single mother. And mm-hmm. in season two, while you're working at the port, you uncovered a human trafficking ring with the help yeah. of Officer Jimmy McNulty, who you ended up living with. He moved in with you eventually. And he'd had problems with drinking. But mm-hmm. he gave that up to live with you and your children. But by season five, he was drinking again a lot. And yeah. I want to play a scene in which okay. you go visit at the police station, his former partner, Bunk, who was also yeah. frequently his drinking partner. And you ask Bunk if he thinks that Jimmy can straighten out again. And Bunk is played by Wendell Pierce. So here's the scene.
Hey.
Busy?
No. Just, Jimmy's not in yet.
I know. He's sleeping one off.
Late night, huh?
They're all like that now. Relax, I'm not looking for a snitch. I know you're his partner in crime. I don't care.
Whoa, Beattie.
I just want to know from you where this is going. I mean, you know him. You know what it is that he can and can't do.
I don't know if I can speak on that.
Look, I'm ready to put him out, okay? For me, for my kids. I mean, if in the end, if this is all there is to him, if he can't be better than this, I just want to know.
He's working this case right now. Serial killer, actually.
You are not going to try to tell me that this is about a case. Try that on some civilian.
Look, he'll get his head in a certain place. He'll take a drink. I mean, a lot of us will.
It's more than just a drink he's taking.
Well, Beattie, I can't tell you what to do.
I don't like giving up. Okay, I gotta go back to work. Thanks for letting me vent.
That's my guest, Amy Ryan, with Wendell Pierce in a scene from season five of The Wire. You're so great. How did you get the part in The Wire?
At the time, Alexa Fogel, who's casting director here in New York, she works with David Simon quite a lot, and I'd known Alexa for years. She'd been someone who really was a champion of mine since I started my career. And Alexa brought me in for it, and that was that. But I'd been a fan of the show from the first season, and it was quite surreal to join that cast, to go down to Baltimore and meet this incredible group, this company of actors. It was a real thrill.
Yeah, I can imagine. It's such an extraordinary group that worked on The Wire. How did the prep and the direction compare to other shows that you'd worked on? And you'd worked on other shows as series regulars, but also as, you know, look, you know, the guest star on various cop and other mm-hmm. shows.
Well, I think the world of David Simon's story really does come first, no matter what. And without giving anything away, I know a lot of people are new to The Wire through DVD rentals and even it wouldn't matter which character was the most popular and on the message boards or, you know, fan write-in letters or whatever it may be. If that character had to go because the story, it needed to go in that direction, they would get killed or die or something. I think David had a formula where every 5 episodes someone died, whether it was a main character or just a passerby on the street. We all quickly assess that right away. I mean, we as a company were really respectful and excited by that. That story was going to drive it. And there weren't going to be any great stars that, you know, like I think other shows have the potential to spin off characters and you can become a star from that. With David, the story is always the star. And ultimately, I think that makes actors look better.
Did you feel vulnerable not ever knowing if your character was going to get killed or your character was going to be written into the next season?
No. I mean, certainly, I mean, I actually believe I signed on for maybe a 4-year contract. And season 2, I was in every episode. And then season 3, 4, and 5, David told me, you know, look, I'm not going to use you as much. And it's not personal. But the real truth is I couldn't make you detective. Just that's not the way it works. You're a port police officer. If this were a network TV show, I could write one scene where, oh, yeah, Beattie went away and she passed the test. But that's not how it works. You couldn't go from port police officer to homicide detective in, you know, a hiatus break. You know, he's like, it's not going to happen. So, you know, at the time I was disappointed because I loved, you know, being a part of the show and the company. But, you know, my mother always, you know, tells me over and over something better's around the corner. Or not better, but in this case, different. And a whole bunch of other things happened in my career simply by being available.
What happened?
I was nominated for an Oscar, for one. I was nominated for a Tony, for two. Not in that order, but just variety. Variety. I mean, that's the, you know, being on a series is in some ways a double-edged sword. You know, it's great. It's great security. And certainly, artistically, it can be phenomenal experience like The Wire was for me. But then you're also, you know, you're signed on for 5 years. So you just simply aren't available if other things come along.
So the Tony was for Streetcar Named Desire?
That's right. Yes.
And the Oscar nomination was for Gone Baby Gone?
That's right.
I want to play a scene from a great movie that you were in, Gone Baby Gone. And this is a crime drama based on a Dennis Lehane novel. It's directed by Ben Affleck and stars Casey Affleck, his brother.
And Dennis was also a writer, excuse me for interrupting, Dennis was also a writer on The Wire.
Oh, yes, that's right. Good point.
Yeah.
How you got the part in Gone Baby Gone?
No, it's just I hadn't actually met Dennis until I went back the fifth year, season 5, rather, after I'd done, I think I'd already filmed Gone Baby Gone and went back and did that final episode.
Oh, okay. So let me set up the scene and then we'll hear it. So
okay.
Casey Affleck is a private eye who sees you on TV saying that your child Amanda has been kidnapped. But you turn out, you know, he takes the case, but you turn out to be a pretty bad mother and not a very nice person. You and your boyfriend Ray have been selling drugs. And in this scene, you're being questioned by two cops. Your sister B, played by Amy Madigan, is also in the room listening. Ed Harris plays the cop who's asking most of the questions. And he wants to know what you know about a drug dealer named Cheese who was ripped off. And you've just confessed that you worked for Cheese as a mule carrying drugs and that you took tens of thousands of dollars that belonged to Cheese. And you're explaining here how that happened.
Okay.
Me and Ray had to do this run up Nashua, right?
Yeah.
We dropped 4 keys on these bikers. When we was walking back through the motel with all the money, these cops just swooped right in, went right for the bikers. And Amanda was with us, so we just pretended to be like a family. We got in the car, took off.
You took Amanda with you?
Oh, what am I going to do, leave her in the car, B? I don't got no daycare. It's really hard being a mother. It's hard raising a family, you know? All on my own. But God made you barren, so you and know, so I understand, B, okay?
You are an abomination.
Hey.
As God is
right here.
Witness.
Right here. What happened next?
He was driving back, and Ray... Ray was like, you know everyone's going to think the cops got the money.
You told Cheese the cops got it.
Well, you and Ray kept the money.
This whole thing is Ray's fault.
Where's the money now, Helene?
It's with Ray.
And where's Ray?
Chelsea.
Okay, that's Amy Ryan in a scene from the movie Gone Baby Gone. Oh, it must be so great to read lines like, "It's hard being a mother, but God made you barren, so you wouldn't know."
Her words are her weapons, line. Huh? She's got an arsenal of weapons in her vocabulary.
Who did you think of when you were taking on this character? I mean, she is a really, like, tough, nasty person. And a very, like, local neighborhood kind of person. Like you'd know the neighborhood she was from, I suppose.
Yes. Starting with Dennis's book, there's so much beautiful and detailed description about Helene and even her thoughts, what's going on in her mind from moment to moment. So that was a great springboard. And then, you know, honestly, when we got to Boston and we're shooting in Dorchester, and this is the neighborhood in which Helene comes from, and just meeting the local people there. And it's not to say that there are Helenes on every block, but there are a few. And with any part, I try to humanize them as much as she is a monster. But there is a reason she ended up in this situation. There's a moment where she was the child born to a similar mother. And how do you break this cycle? And where does it start? Where does it end? And try to think of it from her point of view. Certainly, I don't condone her behavior, but I could understand it. You know, even that moment she says to B, "What am I going to do, leave her in the car?" That is her best parenting. You know, I'm happy to know I'm a better parent than she is.
But, I hope so.
But, you know, that's what she knows. And so with any part, it's trying not to judge the character as much as just be them.
What about the Boston accent, very neighborhood Boston accent? How did you do it without overdoing it?
Well, every moment, you know, every time there's a break on set, you know, lots of actors go check their phone or messages, or you go over to the craft service and you get a snack. I would sit with every Teamster possible and who were from the area and just, talk to them. How was your weekend? What'd you get up to? And keep that sound going constantly with me. And then I had the good fortune of my director, Ben Affleck, and the star of the movie, Casey Affleck, were helping me along the way. They would just say, I don't even know if I can do it anymore, but they say, it's not, you know, it's not Mada, or I can't do it. But they would keep me on my toes there. And also, the young woman who played my best friend in the movie, Jill Quigg, is... she was a non-actor. She's an actor now, but Ben discovered her just literally on the street.
I'm so glad you say that, because she seemed like a non-actor. There just seemed to be something just like so authentically who she was in the movie.
Yeah, she actually broke through. There's a story. My first day of shooting, I couldn't get onto set. They called for me, and I walked over from my trailer, and there were a lot of neighbors out watching filming, and there was a little police barricade set up, asking them to stand behind, and I had to walk through that, and I couldn't get on set. One of the production assistants thought I was a neighbor just trying to meet Ben Affleck. And I tried out the Boston accent. I was like, no, I'm in the movie. He says, no, just stand there. So I was late 20 minutes until a producer finally recognized me. She got me through the barricade. But Jill Quigg, watching filming one day, broke through the barrier, no problem, went right up to Ben Affleck and demanded a part in the movie, basically.
How did she break through? What was her thing?
She's her savvy. That's her survival skill in that neighborhood. So,
and what did Ben Affleck recognize in her?
Authenticity. Ben had said before we started this movie, he said, you know, I don't know if I'm going to end up being a good director. I don't know if I'm going to get it right, but I know I'm going to get Boston right. And he's expressed how it was frustrating to him all these years watching movies that, you know, people just get up there and it's like, park your car and have a yard, you know, the whole kind of exaggeration of Boston. But he really wanted to show, you know, a much more real side to it. So by casting locals, he also said, you know, it's going to be a bigger challenge for the actors in the film. You have to blend in. You have to assimilate with them.
You know, you said that when you tried to, there was a moment when you tried to get onto the set and they wouldn't let you through on the street in Boston because they thought you were just a fan and that you were lying when you said that you were actually in the movie.
Yeah.
Does that mean that they didn't think you looked like a genuine movie star?
I think they thought I was genuine Dorchester, which was even better. But no, I rarely get mistaken for a genuine movie star, but I prefer that. That's why I live in New York. Because I think once, too, you're a genuine movie star, then, you know, it's hard to hide away and become other people. You know, certainly movie stars like Sean Penn can do it. Meryl Streep can do it. But I'm wary of being too glossied, mm-hmm. because then, you know, you don't get to play the real people. And that's what I find most fascinating.
I was so delighted to see you in The Office, to see you in a comedy, because I hadn't seen you in a comedy before that, and you do it so well. I want you to describe your character, Holly, in The Office.
Holly Flax was the new head of human resource at Dunder Mifflin, and quite serious about her job, and shortly finds, a comrade and kinship to Michael Scott, played by the great Steve Carell.
And, you know, Michael is such a clueless person. He gets everything wrong. He always thinks he's funny when he's really not. What makes it possible for your character to click so well with him?
I think Holly shares the same cornball sense of humor with Michael. You know, they're both, you know, he's more odd, but she's slightly odd. And, you know, I just like to say there's a lid for every pot.
Let's hear a scene from The Office with you and Steve Carell. And this is after you've left the Scranton branch for another branch. And then you and Michael meet again at a company picnic that's bringing together the employees from all the branches. But you show up with your new boyfriend.
Oh, yeah.
Nevertheless, you and Michael decide to write a sketch together to perform at the picnic. And the sketch is supposed to be a history of the paper company you work for, Dunder Mifflin. But you're doing it as a parody of Slumdog Millionaire. And for any of our listeners who haven't seen Slumdog Millionaire, it's a film set in India in which a young man from the slums ends up being a contestant on the Indian version of the quiz show Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. And when this young man keeps getting answers right in spite of his lack of education and he keeps winning more and more money, he's taken by the police who torture him to find out how he's managing to get the right answers. So here's you as Holly with Michael, played by Steve Carell, doing this the Slumdog Millionaire satire at the Dunder Mifflin picnic.
And now, presenting
Slumdunder Mifflinaire! Are you ready to play Slumdunder Mifflinaire?
Yes, I am.
For $100, where did Dunder meet Mifflin? A. On Easy Street. B. A tour of Dartmouth College. C, they never met. D, brushing their teeth.
Oh, I'm thinking. I'm going to say B, tour of Dartmouth College.
That is correct. How did you know that?
No! Oh! Ah! I was there! I was a tour guide at Dartmouth College. No!
Nice campus. Think you'll get in?
Yeah, I'm definitely getting in. I'm a shoo-in.
I'm Robert Dunder.
I'm Robert Mifflin.
Robert Mifflin had a great life, but unfortunately had undiagnosed depression, which over 9 million Americans suffer from and is very treatable. For $250, how did he kill himself? A, a rope. B, a knife. C, a gun. D, brushing his teeth.
$250 is more money than I've ever seen in my life. I will say C, a gun. He shot himself in the head.
That is correct!
Yes!
That is so funny. You know, the children at the picnic are horrified. And actually,
horrified.
Everyone is kind of horrified as they hear you doing this, like, awful routine, tasteless routine.
And the thing is, that's what I love about those characters. They think they're killing it. They're just, you know.
I know. You can't wipe the smile off your face. You are enjoying this so much. You think it's so funny.
They're wonderful. And, you know, but it's when we, obviously Steve and I knew that was the joke, you know, that they bomb. But when we had to get up and perform it, and obviously everyone else is directed not to laugh and look horrified, there's a part of you as an actor, you're still standing on a stage, however makeshift, in the middle of a park, and you're not getting a reaction. You start like breaking out into a cold sweat, like trying to get a laugh, trying to make them like you. But and every time we had to redo it, we're like, oh my God, I don't think I can go back out there. You know? But it was a good laugh.
So did you write any of the lines yourself?
Not in that scene, I don't think. I remember the part, obviously, what the listeners won't be able to see is the visual of that scene is as we're torturing, I get to torture Steve. I started pulling out his fingernails with my teeth. That was one form of torture. I was very chuffed with myself for coming up with that. The office is pretty tightly scripted, and it's not until the third or fourth time through a take that they let you play around. Well, certainly Steve, and I wait and I take his lead. If he starts going off course, then I'll follow him if I can keep up.
How did you get the part in The Office?
You know, The Wire actually led to The Office, funny enough. All the writers on The Office are all huge fans of The Wire, and it was really just also that, and there's part coincidence that right after the Oscars, I knew the next choice I made would have to be a good one. And I was also well aware that all the offers I was about to get would be of, you know, parts of single drug-addicted mothers. It's what was on people's minds. And so I wanted to keep a couple of steps ahead of people.
Because that's what you played in Gone Baby Gone, yeah.
Yes, exactly. And so I thought, well, what would surprise people? One would be a comedy, and two would be if I put on a skirt and brushed my hair. I thought that would work well. So I had mentioned that to my agent, and he had called over to the office just to see if there was anything coming up that I might be right for. And they coincidentally had been thinking of me because they were familiar with The Wire.
So I'd like to hear more about you. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Queens. I grew up in Flushing, Queens. In the house my father grew up in. I
really?
Had two older sisters. Mm-hmm. It was very neighborhood. My grandmother and grandfather lived five blocks away.
What was the neighborhood like? What was the ethnic makeup?
It was mixed. It was Jewish families, Chinese families. There was a Korean family at the top of the block. My family, which was Polish and Irish and English. We were kind of a mix, mutt of it all. And it was very much, I like to say, Archie Bunker, but with a driveway. We had, you know, house, driveway. We could play kickball in the street. Every 5 minutes or so, we'd have to stop because a car came down the block. But it was a fun neighborhood to grow up in. And we still, you know, you can be a kid, but yet we still had access to Manhattan, which my parents, they took us to the city as much as possible. And I think that's what got me interested in theater, was just as we stood in line at TKTS whenever we could.
Well, you went to the High School of Performing Arts.
So I did, yeah.
How did that compare to either the movie or TV version of Fame?
It actually compares, it's pretty similar to the original film. It's nothing like the TV series, and I didn't see the remake of Fame that just came out last year, so I can't speak of that. But it was quite a magical place. You know, for me, coming from Queens where, you know, my school friends I'd known since kindergarten, and then I guess I was 14 years old when I went in for sophomore year or so, I'm surrounded by a bunch of really creative kids and from all economic backgrounds and all five boroughs of the city, and it was a real, it was a real eye-opener. It was great. It was a small, and the building used to be on 46th Street, and it was this tiny little conservatory, and you would be in history class, but you can hear chamber music echoing through the halls. Or I remember one day actually being bored in history class, daydreaming out, you know, looking out the window, or rather the door frame, and this dancer walked by, and he caught my eye, and he kept walking, but then he came back, and he did this huge leap
probably like 6 feet in the air, or so it seemed to me. And no one else saw. It was just this moment. This is a dancer flying by, and I just thought, I can't believe this is high school. it was a beautiful place. And also, you know, to have training in theater and not put my parents in debt. You know, it's a school. It's a New York City public high school, so it was free.
So when you were in the High School of Performing Arts studying acting, how important was being pretty? Because being pretty is pretty highly prized in high school, period. But also in acting, being pretty or handsome is very highly prized if you want leading man and leading lady kind of roles.
Yeah, you know, I did not see any of that within my class. Unless I was naive, but I don't remember kids being body conscious or, you know, beauty conscious. We were really all about the work. We were so immersed in that world. And, you know, we would study Stanislavski's The Method. So we took ourselves very seriously. and it wasn't about having the right hair and clothing and, you know. Although, you know, we did know who the pretty people were. And, you know, that was Jennifer Aniston was one of those people.
Was she in your class?
She was a year younger than me. Yeah. You know who they are then. She had great hair then. but it was all a pretty tight-knit group of kids.
So this was in the 80s, right, that you would have been in high school?
Yeah.
So what were some of the touchstone movies and shows for you then?
Well, upon graduation, you know, my first job, I did Biloxi Blues. I did this touring production of Biloxi Blues. And there was an actor I worked with on that called Andrew Polk, and who really was like a big brother to me. And he took me to see a bunch of movies which would later influence me. The first one was Down by Law, the Jim Jarmusch movie.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, I suddenly started loving the world of Mike Leigh and all these regular people. I think that's where that influence came from. And the first movie I saw of his was High Hopes. So that was the big influence.
Did you have stage fright then? Because the shows that you'd done had basically been in high school, and suddenly you were touring around the country.
I didn't have stage fright then. I was way too young to even think of it. I had a bit of stage fright during the final week of Streetcar Named Desire on Broadway, and I think it was just out of pure exhaustion, and that play really takes a toll on you physically and emotionally. And there was a moment where this is the opening scene, and we had a week to go, and I, for the first time ever, had this I had this dialogue going on in my head where I just said, oh, I'm just so tired. I just want to sit down and cry. I just want to sit on the stage right here. And at the same time, miraculously, these lines are coming out. Blanche, oh, you know, that whole first scene when Blanche and Stella are, you know, reunited, and it's joyous. And my body, I actually got a little scared because my body started to, you know, probably lost 3 inches in height because I started to go down. And I was a little afraid to go back onto the next scene. But actually, it was Natasha Richardson who I was playing that version of Streetcar with. And she just gave me a big hug and said, right, back out we go, you know, and set me on the right course.
So, you know, in talking about Streetcar, what were the difficulties of playing Stella? Streetcar is such a sexual play. I mean, so much of the text and the subtext is all about sex.
Oh, yeah. I had the great fortune of doing this play twice. The first time I got to do it down at the Kennedy Center with Patricia Clarkson as Blanche, directed by Gary Hines. And Patty actually found old letters that Tennessee Williams had written that said, I'm writing a new play. It's about two sisters. And I think often, you know, because of the, you know, obviously Marlon Brando made such an impression on Stanley and the Blanche, that play usually finds two stars to play those roles, and it outshines Stella. But we brought it back to the triangle. And if Blanche and Stanley aren't fighting over Stella, I feel like productions really miss out a huge point of that play.
Mm-hmm.
And also, Stella, her, you know, Tennessee's description of Stella is that she's lying in bed reading movie magazines, eating chocolates with her painted fingernails, and she just
she's waiting in bed for her husband to come home. And that's the first part of Streetcar Named Desire, her desire. You know, it's more famously, you know, gets into Blanche and Stanley's relationship. But it starts, I mean, that's why she's with him, you know. She doesn't have any more money. They came from money, but she doesn't have any more. Stanley doesn't have any more. They come from different, you know, class, you know, backgrounds. So why else would these two people be together? And that's just because they're mad for each other. They can't keep their hands off each other.
Amy Ryan, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, you too, Terry. I appreciate it.
Amy Ryan co-stars in the new thriller Green Zone, which opens tomorrow. Since she was in two TV series we love, The Office and The Wire, we've put links to all of our interviews with people from those shows on our website, freshair.npr.org, where you can also see clips from her new film.
For filmmakers, musicians, and digitally creative people, Austin, Texas is the place to be this week. It's the site of the annual South by Southwest Festival, where new movies are screened, new artists are showcased, and new applications are launched. It is also where Leanne Hansen is this weekend, and she joins us from member station KUT in Austin to tell us about it. Hey there, Leanne.
Hey there, Audie.
So what's going on?
Oh, it's amazing. The interactive component of the festival got underway Friday, and I'll tell you, this place is crawling with young people, old people, tattooed people. I've even spotted a few guys wearing kilts. The place is wired. I mean, there are lounges in the convention center where you can go have yourself a drink while you're recharging all of your devices. But the main interactive attraction this weekend is something that they're calling Screen Burn Arcade. It's a huge exhibition room, and there's going to be a video game tournament held there, but it's one of the places that's actually open to the public, and it's free. And you go in, and there are just all of these new games and lights and music, and I saw a lot of kids and their parents walking around checking out, you know, all the latest in gaming technology. In fact, the first thing I saw was a few kids up on a small stage playing the popular video game Rock Band. And the whiz-bang electronic technology in the arcade, I mean, really was a magnet for a lot of people. But I have to tell you, they were also attracted to a giant Lego setup that had everything from the Taj Mahal and Yoda made out of Legos. So there were some low-tech attractions, too.
Yeah, Legos never get old. But it all fun and games?
No, actually, there's some very serious work going on here. Networking, first of all, a lot of exchange of business cards. But there's a lot of panels and small conferences, just a few titles, How Sci-Fi is Shaping the Internet. There's a panel on the iPad, New Opportunities for Content Creators. There's panels on citizen journalism. There's even one on Cooking for Geeks, which I'm not sure what that one's going to be. Friday, I was able to attend a session on how to fund gaming startups in a recession. And there were about 50 people in the room, and they were learning the do's and don'ts of raising money for their ventures from a gentleman who used to work for Dell, who's been very good at raising money. And he had a list of do's and don'ts. For example, do be confident. You're the expert, not the investor. And don't take every piece of advice because you can't absorb it all. And when the session ended, I met a woman named Susan Drescher, and her business card identified her as the president and chief herder of cats for a company called Extra Feet. She and her business partner have created a game called Evil.
Not too long ago, we were employed by MySpace, and we were released from MySpace when things started happening a year ago. And so we started a company of our own, and we just built a game.
They're trying to get the money to be able to launch it out. And then they said they have something else coming down the pipeline, but they wouldn't tell us. And the session where I met Susan Drescher was just one of some of 50 panels going on Friday. The interactive portion of the festival lasts 4 days. So, you know, do the math. 50 panels, 4 days. I mean, that's a lot of panels. And since it's impossible to go to each one, we tracked down Hugh Forrest, who's the event director for South by Southwest. And he gave us the big picture. How did Austin and South by Southwest become the mecca for all of these pilgrims?
Well, as you know, South by Southwest was originally a music event, and it still is a very strong music event, and that's the base of what we do. I think that, or I know that if there wasn't a music event to support what we did, we wouldn't have survived some of the very lean years. But in terms of why the event has grown and become a mecca, I mean, I think there are lots of different factors here. I mean, I think the geeks like being on the same stage as musicians, so to speak. And I say geeks in a totally loving way. I mean, the digital creatives who attend the event love to be on that same stage. And it's also very important that we have this big film event going on at the same time. I mean, again, the most meaningful connections that people make here are usually with someone completely outside of their industry that, wow, you mean you need a website and you make films and I need this film content and, you know, this is a great connection. And so, again, it's bringing these different people together and hopefully making these connections.
Do you mind if I just go through a random picking, a lucky dip of some of these panels? Okay. Cybersex 2.0. Is social networking ruining your sex life?
I got to say, that's one of the big questions or issues in this community is the more you tweet or the more you blog or the more you're transparent on the web, how does that impact your relationships, casual and more so?
What we learned watching kids with homemade flamethrowers.
That was a slam dunk in terms of accepting that. It's about tracking memes. One of the more popular memes, as we may or may not know, is people on YouTube with homemade flamethrowers. So the panel will be discussing that in specific, but trying to learn some more details on how these things go virally and why they go virally and what makes it spread and what doesn't make it spread.
And the other one, I mean, it seems like this is an issue that people are just beginning to think about. My Life Take Two. No, it's not My Life Take Two, The Right to Delete.
Yeah.
Oh, here we go. Your Online Identity After Death and Digital Wills.
Sure.
Which goes along with, you know, deleting one's
life. Yeah, we did one session on that last year, and we create this virtual presence more and more with our new technologies. What happens to that presence when you pass away? Do you will that on to someone else to essentially keep on your virtual existence, or how does that work? And there are lots of services, or there's some services that help you with that process now. Now, the other session you mentioned was My Right to Delete, which is, again, in this brave new world we live in, the things we say or do often get onto the internet, and it's impossible to get rid of them. How do we move on if and when we want to move on?
Right. So how do you get the bad stuff off the web that your, you know, sister put up there? From when you were a kid, you know.
Absolutely.
Hugh Forrest, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Audie, I mean, as you can see how difficult it would be to choose between, you know, cyber sex and cooking for geeks if they're going on at the same time. I actually heard somebody say that he wasn't going to bother to make up a schedule of things to go to. He preferred the Twitterverse to guide him, so he'd tweet and ask, where's the best place to go next? And I also can't talk about the festival without mentioning Twitter. I mean, everyone really is walking around with mobile devices, eyes down, fingers flying, and I'm surprised people aren't crashing into one another. Actually, while we were waiting in line to pick up our credential, there was a gentleman who actually made what we called a Twitter pitch.
So you guys on Twitter? We're trying to raise money for charity. And if we get 5,000 tweets with a hashtag in it, then we get $5,000 for charity by 5 p.m.
All right, Leanne, so what's next?
Well, we're hoping to catch up with some of the film people. There seem to be as many screenings as there are panels. We've actually done an interview already with a young man with a company that has a developing technology to make it easy to create video games. So we'll bring back that story. And by the way, we're meeting a lot of NPR fans here at South by Southwest. And they actually, a lot of them are listening on the new NPR iPhone app, which is, I suppose, not too surprising, given that everyone here is, as they say, digitally creative.
Leanne Hansen speaking to us from KUT in Austin, Texas. And you'll be back next week, right?
You betcha.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.